Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast of solutions and the podcast of hope. And I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and I'm delighted that today it's the third of our series with, in partnership with the National Women's Council, looking at issues in the run-up and around International Women's Day 2021. And I'm delighted to be joined by the director of the National Women's Council, Orla O'Connor. Orla, I'm delighted to have you back again as co-host.
Thanks, Rory. And we're delighted to be doing this series with you for International Women's Day.
We've talked about inequality a lot in this podcast, and in terms of, you know, even in the last two we've covered women with disability, you know, we've covered the broader, you know, issues around and creating inclusive feminism. And it is about a feminism that is inclusive. And today I'm really delighted and that we're going to cover one of the biggest human rights violations that has been going in Ireland is the whole issue of direct provision and the treatment of people within that. And it's one of the scars on our nation, what we have done to people. But I'm going to hand over to you now, Orla, to cover this issue. And thanks so much for being here. And again, the importance of getting these voices out into the public domain.
Yeah, absolutely. In terms of what you just said about the importance of this particular podcast, because I think this is such a critical issue in terms of experience of women in direct provision, and also, and we'll be talking about that, what are women's views in terms of the white paper and the government's plans for direct provision. So I'm joined today by three brilliant women who are real experts in this area and have also had experience in this area. So we're joined by Ola Mustafa, we're joined by Rosemary Kunene, and also Ellie Kasambi. So we're going to have a discussion on those sort of critical issues for women in direct provision, which very much need to be a part of our discussions on International Women's Day. So, you know, I think to start, I think it would be really sort of, I think, helpful to know from your own sense of things, what do you see as the important issues around the experience of women in direct provision, and particularly, I suppose, as well at the moment with regard to COVID? Ola, would you like to start off?
Hi, Orla. It's good to be a part of your event again. And I think the last time I saw you was in the FemFest in 2019. And it just it goes a long way to tell us how fickle this society or this world that we live in is, and we just have to make use of every moment that life throws at us. So, but anyway, thank you so much for having me. For a woman living in direct provision, there are lots of issues, especially when it comes to parenting. You know, I have three kids. I have a 12-year-old, a 10-year-old, and a 7-year-old. And my 7-year-old happens to have additional needs, and that keeps me on my toes. Every minute of the day, he doesn't have a sense of awareness of danger, and that means I have to be ahead of the game all the time. And I'm doing my thing as well, and combined with the anxiety of you not hearing anything from the Department of Justice concerning your application, and everything just is just interwoven, and it affects every area of your lives. And aside the fact that you are parenting out of fear. You know, here in direct provision, you have people from different backgrounds, people who you don't know their precedents, you don't know their values, you don't know their perspectives on life, you don't know their cultural background, you know, and you just get all these people together and you just dump them in a space to cohabit and you know, hopefully they will be able to cohabit peacefully. And that means you have to parent out of understanding of the other person's views. You have to parent bearing in mind that your parenting techniques or your own values that you're trying to pass to your children doesn't collide or doesn't clash with that of the other person. And that's where all the trouble come from. Your child makes a lot of noise. Oh, your child causes trouble. Oh, your child does this. Your child does that. And you know, it just puts this whole burden on you. You have to be a perfect parent when you are in direct provision. You can't be imperfect. You have to be perfect. You have to get it right. And that is a lot of expectations for people who are in a vulnerable state. You're parenting such that your children doesn't go out there and, you know, act in such a way that people won't say, oh, children in direct provision or children of a black from a black background, that's how they behave, or that's how they do. You know, you just have to get it. And it's so unfair that there's so much burden that is put on you because of your circumstances. And I think that is something that calls for a kind of a reassessment on the part of everyone who looks at this system as this is what we have to offer. You know, it calls for a kind of a mutual support and a mutual love, kind of just working our way around, complementing each other and helping each other out when it comes to women issues and raising children and things like that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, from what you describe, it's an impossible situation. Like, it's an impossible parent, impossible, even more impossible now. Rosemary, do you want to maybe say your own thoughts about the experience for women?
Hi, Ola. Thank you so much for having me here. And I think Ola has just finalized everything. She said it all. Like, I don't know what to add to what she has said. You know, for someone living in direct provision, like for herself with children, the other thing that she'll be experiencing is isolation, because she's all by herself. Trying, a woman by yourself with the children, you're trying to raise the kids, but at the same time also you have to live your life. So literally your life is on hold. There's literally nothing that you can do. Like, at least now we have things like maybe studying or community activities happening on Zoom. Let's look back when we didn't have Zoom. You're stuck with the kids. You take the kids to school, you come back, you just sit in the room and you're waiting for the kids to come back. You're preparing the food for the children, and they can't eat the kind of food that they have on the table because maybe they're not something that they're used to, or maybe the food is just being a repetition. And when you have like teenage children, it's also just gets worse because you have your own burden, you have your own problems, and also you have this child who is coming to you looking for support, looking for help, and you cannot give that support. So really, for women in direct provision, life is just on hold. And there is the mental health that has experienced for women in direct provision leads to low self-esteem, whereby the woman cannot pick themselves up. That's why sometimes you'd find that women living so long in direct provision, they will just lose that will to live. They don't see the purpose of wanting to live. And at the end of the day, they become vulnerable in the sense that they'll go on the street, they'll meet anyone who is going to promise them the roses that are not there. And they'll end up going into with this particular person. And this is not only for older women, even the young women, but they become so vulnerable that someone will come to them and tell them, you know what, if you do ABC, you're going to have money. Like, I would give an example for myself. When I was living in direct provision, I had a gentleman coming up to me and telling me, I have a job for you. And I was like, what kind of a job is that? Oh, okay, I'm going to sell you. You're going to go to this particular house, and there'll be a taxi coming to pick you from the center, and you get paid for 100 euro, and it's just going to take you 5 minutes. And I said, I can't do that. He's like, you need the money. You have your children back at home. You need the money. So this is easy money for you. And the way he was so convincing, he even said, are you stupid? Have you never had sex? Is it something new for you? But because I knew what I wanted, I stood my ground. I said, no, I'm not doing this. And that wasn't the first time. Even someone that was my friend came to me and said, oh, Rose, there's a business. There's a guy outside at the gate. He's looking for a woman. Can you go and then we share the money? I said, over my dead body. So you see the vulnerability that the women are put into. And then at the end of the day, they're all being put in one box. And then you've been hearing all the negative things that the media says about you. And you know exactly what you are going through. It's just like adding more load on the heaviness of the load that you are already carrying. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosemary. I mean, you know, I think your description really, I think, shows people, you're right, absolutely, the vulnerability of women the abuse that the system is causing on people, but also that piece when you were saying about the isolation and despair. I think, yeah, you know, you've certainly made it very real for people. Ellie. Yeah. So, Elliot, we're talking about, just to start off, the experience of women in direct provision. So do you want to say just your own sense of that and, you know, what you'd have to say about that?
Yes, thank you so much, guys. I'm sorry, you won't see my face. I just had so much happening this morning. But anyway, yeah. So, you know, like as a woman that I've gone through direct provision, you know, women, we are not just bound to be women, that we are in, find ourselves in this traumatic and difficult situation. Culturally, from the background, or even here in Ireland, I think we have a little more similarities of women being the pillars of our families. And in doing so, direct provision as a woman makes you to make not only decisions that they can wreck you as a person, but you actually bound to make decisions considering your family, considering the children that you're raising, and also sometimes considering the community that you've actually made. Women, we've been not only programmed, but to be looked as people that, even sometimes when we are coming across and making points or addressing an issue, we are people that we are teared before even we address those issues. And being a vulnerable woman coming from direct provision, it just makes things worse. At the end of the day, women become not very much active. You become less self-esteem. And also sometimes you doubt, you know, like in every decision that you actually wake up to make. Direct provision system is a system that, in my own opinion and in my own reasoning, I've actually said that it's a system that sometimes, if you see, or although sometimes we speak about the difficulties of direct provision, but if you can go into more detailed, and if you can actually see the more exploitation that this system has done, it has even done more to women. I don't even understand what that really happened or why is that so. But you can understand, you can see that the more experience that women goes through in direct provision, and even the experience that men goes through in direct provision, are totally different. I'm telling you, women are treated awful. And maybe these women, they can actually agree with you on that one. And, you know, like, these are some of the stuff that, you know, this system has done to women, like myself and many other women. I don't know if that answers your question.
And just to add to what Ellie is saying about you, the experiences of women and the experiences of men in direct provision, it's totally different. Most of the women in direct provision they would be women who have children, so they would be single moms. And so imagine you wanting to progress in life, and there is this manager that tells you, if you leave your children in this hostel and you go to school or you go anywhere, I'm calling the social on you, I'm doing this and I'm doing that. And there goes your dreams of you ever adding any value to your life or wanting to go after anything, you know. I remember when I first, my first attempt to go to school, I think it was in 2016 or 2017. And there's this PLC course that we are always told that that's the only thing that you can do. And I enrolled in a child care course. My son was just, it was just one then. And I had to look for somebody to mind him. And on the long run, I started hearing, oh, the then manager was saying, I hear you leave your child behind and you go blah, blah, blah. Like, there's somebody minding him. So why would that be any problem? Eventually, I had to quit that school, because the lady minding the child couldn't bear it anymore, and she had her own child as well. And so it was like me putting all these burdens and all my problems on her, and she was responsible for my own problem and her own problem, and it was just a roller coaster. I had to quit midway, and it's not an isolated event. That's the experience of a lot of us. So I agree with what Ellie said about you. The experiences, it differs a lot.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I think that, you know, that sense as well of women trying to hold it all together, and the pressure and the stress that must cause. One of the things I think that people would be really interested to hear from the three of you is your opinions, your thoughts on the government's new plans around direct provision, and particularly your thoughts in terms of where you see women within that. I know the government have said that these are gender sensitive plans. I think everyone would be really interested to hear what you think about that. So maybe, Rosemary, do you want to maybe start and say maybe your thoughts?
For me, it's like, I have the faith that people are making changes. When I say people, I meant the government. Yeah, I see the talks are there. I don't see the political will in ending this, because I don't see really the plan to be feasible. Mm-hmm. And I if I really say what's in my heart, it will just be too negative. But I want to maintain a bit of like positivity. Yeah, they are trying their best, and I see that there is a bit of like improvement from the time I was in direct provision. But I don't see the feasibility of all that are happening. And like even like the 4 months that they're saying that people would stay in 4 months and then they would go into their own accommodation, I don't see the 4 months feasible. And for me, at the end of the day, what all this is causing some kind of like fight between the most vulnerable people in our community. You have those people fighting for the rights of the homeless people to say, okay, look after our own first. Where are they going to be housed? Like I was reading the journal.ie and the comments from people, like they were actually bringing me chills. And for me, I was like, okay, yes, direct provision system, it is bad. But the question that I have, and this is my own personal opinion, the challenge that we have is the long stay in direct provision centers. So has that been tackled? Has that been said to say, okay, even if we move you in your own accommodation, you're not going to take this long to await for your decision? And there's all this bureaucracy. There's all this, like there's no straightforward of someone going to seek asylum and have their cases being heard. There's always all these excuses, different excuses, and one has to be strong to go through all that. So have they addressed how fair are they going to be? Because yes, we have issue of direct provision, and the direct provision issue comes in because of the long stay of the people in the centers. So if they were to address how they're going to make the interviews easier, I don't know if easier is the right way, or should I use the word fair? Because you would go into the interview and you're telling them something that it is true, but they'll be comparing to what happens in Ireland. And they'll say, oh no, that's not, that cannot happen. And then for me, what I used to ask is, okay, you think that cannot happen because you're comparing to Ireland. Where's the evidence that you have? Show me your own evidence that says this cannot happen. So those kind of things are the things that they're supposed to address, training the people, the people who are doing the interview to be more knowledgeable of individual of what happens in different countries, not just to be dismissive. And also having the centers, like, you know, the respect that people need in the centers. Like there was, sorry, maybe I might take too much time. Tell me when to shut up.
You're fine.
There is this, they brought in this, to say, before I left the DP center, there was this cooking for yourself, going into the shop and, you getting your own food. And we're all excited. Yeah, we're cooking by ourselves. But there was no freedom in cooking for yourself there. Because you go to buy the food, you're not even finding the food that you want. Is the reputation the same chicken? I remember I used to fight for simple green vegetables. I'm like, I love to eat vegetables because I think it's healthy for me. That's the only healthy food I can eat at the moment. And it was hard to buy for them to just go and get simple green vegetables and give the people. And I was also asking to say, if you want to give people the freedom, why are you bringing shops inside the centers? Why don't you give the voucher and people go and shop by themselves? Go in the shop, at least smile at someone else that you don't even live with. At least they laugh with the cashier, not someone just coming, oh, what do you want? Oh, check. You want Colgate? Oh, check. You want to first check? Like, why not changing that? So in my own opinion, the way things are done is they just sweetcoat things and make it look like, okay, yeah, we've changed this, we've changed that. But the political will is not there, because it was going to start when they said people will be given that right to cook for themselves, the right to buy what they want. The center managers wouldn't be strict on us and making us still be like children, begging them on what they should buy in the centers. So as for the white paper, for me, I just looked at it and I just said, this is another thing. If I see the political will, and I'll say, yeah, we're going to see the change. But in my own opinion, there is a new direct provision center that is coming up, which will just be a bit different from the current direct provision.
Okay, thanks, Rosemary. Ola.
Oh, Rosemary, I've been telling people around me that I would give I'll give the new minister for justice this benefit of doubt. You know, I've looked at this paper. I don't expect anyone to have read the entire 172 pages. You know, but the one that really caught my eye and caught my interest was from page 59 to page 64, and I really took my time to dwell on that. And it identified that there would be some pathways or recognition of the of rights of people who identify as LGBTQ, people who identify who are older people, people with disabilities, and it also recognizes. It also recognizes
that. Just 1 second, Ola. It's okay. Ali's gone back on mute. Okay. Right. Apologies. Sorry.
It also recognizes that there should be some kind of support for people who are in direct provision, and it recognizes the religious and cultural support aspect of that, which I think is very ambitious. So this is the first time I'm seeing this outlined on paper. So I am going to say I will hold the minister by his words now, and the fact that he's been so engaging. He has been so engaging. At least I've had contact with him now more than 3 times, which that has never happened before since I've been in direct provision. I've not seen that that back and forth, you know, exchange between us. And however, that the paper is so much focused on the accommodation and the housing, and people have freedom and they will have self-contained units and their own door and all that. What happens to the legal aspect of why people are remaining in the system for a very long time? I've been here for 7 years and my case is still being answered via the old system, which means I have to finish with this step and then move to this step and then move to that step. Unlike the new system where you appeal once and then you can apply for leave to remain. The old system, you have to appeal your refugee status, your subsidiary protection, and then if there's need for judicial review, you have to do it and then move to leave to remain. I'm still stuck in subsidiary protection level since 2014, and this is 2021 and I'm still here. And the second one that really caught my attention as well was it recognized that people who have been victims of domestic violence, sexual violence, or gender-based violence need support. And there comes the need for vulnerability assessment, or if they need some kind of a therapy or counseling or whatever it is that would support them while they're staying in the system. Because believe me or not, we've had people who went for interviews and come back to say, that person that interviewed me looked at me and said, oh, you don't look like somebody who has been victim of domestic violence. How do you look at somebody and you are able to tell that this person, nah, she's not. If you meet me one-on-one, you and you hear the way I talk, you'd be like, oh, this one has everything figured out. But no, I've been placed on antidepressants. I have been in and out of therapy. I'm still currently registered at adult mental health facility here in Mayo. You know, these are the things that needs to be taken into consideration. And that paper also identifies that there's need to train the staff who works with asylum seekers. So like Rosemary was saying, that what would sound like a taboo in the ear of your caseworker is your reality. It's your lived experience. This is you. And that's why it's easy for them to say, oh, you don't look like a gay man. Or you don't look like a lesbian woman. Or you don't look bisexual, and you have to prove your sexuality to somebody. It doesn't make any sense. The fact that I'm a lesbian or I'm a gay man doesn't mean I have to go around and you know, dressing in a particular kind of way. It's my life. And you can't say because I'm not a member of any LGBTQ support group that invalidates my life. But the part that is being neglected, which is the most important aspect of life for women who are in direct provision centers, is the fact that it doesn't make any recommendation or any provision for children of parents who are on deportation at the moment. So, for instance, if you are on deportation and your child is transitioning to third level education, you are solely responsible for that child's tuition and whatever it is that they need to support themselves while they are schooling. And that is hard. These are people who have not worked all my life since I came to Ireland. And that is because the government says I'm not qualified. I got my right to work just 2 weeks ago. Now imagine if I had a grown-up child and I had to support that child and me not working for the past 7 years. Imagine how my life would have been. I would have either gone into some kind of a covert mission to make money or some kind of derogatory, you know, things to just support my children. I would like to see the minister putting some kind of provision in place for those set of children. And it's so painful. You're looking at your children and they're asking you, so how will I go to college? And then you begin to feel like a failure, like you brought them here to suffer. And that's not it. We brought them here for stability. We brought them here for safety. We brought them here so that they can have a better life than we did. And I don't think that's a crime. And people would say, oh, economic migrants, there's no big deal about you being an economic migrant. Or there's nobody that travels. Irish people have migrated to Australia, migrated to US and UK and all that. And they went for work. Nobody comes here to say, oh, I'm just going to sit down and just enjoy the 19 euros and enjoy the 21 euros and then enjoy the 38 euros. That's not the life, you know. I think it's high time that the system starts identifying and looking at people through the lenses of them being humans and not some freeloaders like we've been called or like, you know, much always wants more, like somebody said to me the other time, and I couldn't for the life of me figure out what it meant by that. And he says, you people are much always wants more. We've been fair to you. We've been this, we've been that. And I'm like, oh my goodness. And yeah, I don't know, it's just so it's really, really tough. There's layers of abuse and discrimination that you feel when you are in this system. And even when you transition outside of the system, people still look at you like, oh, she's an asylum seeker. You people still look at you like, oh, she lives in direct provision. That's not the reality. It's not every colored person or every brown skinned person or everyone that doesn't look like you that you meet on the street that came into the direct provision system. It's you know, we need a fresh perspective. But overall, I think the white paper is very ambitious, and it will only be achievable if at least they give some kind of amnesty to those who have been in the system for a very long time. And that's part of the recommendation by the Catherine Day group. I don't see how this new system would achieve that timeline of abolishing this system in 2024 with over 7,000 residents that they have now. In that wise, it is.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you're so right about the amnesty. Completely agree with you. I mean, in the Women's Council, we've sort of given a cautious welcome to it because on paper it looks good. But we know in Ireland that lots of things look good on paper. They're not necessarily implemented in that way. So it is about the implementation. But you're so right about the amnesty. Like, that has to happen. I mean, I know you know it. Like, 7 years in the system, it's just an appalling abuse of your rights. There's no other way of putting it. It is. It's shocking and it is appalling. Ellie, do you want to come in terms of maybe your thoughts on what's being proposed? We lost Ellie.
Hi, can you hear me there?
Yeah, I can hear you now. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, I got it first on my phone. So I already complained to Sue that my phone rings like a switchboard. So that's why I was interrupting you. And I'm very, very sorry about that.
No, you're okay.
So, in terms of white paper, I have gone through the white paper a little bit, but I was really lucky to actually talk to the government official about the whole white paper concept. One thing I've really liked that you've actually mentioned is, in Ireland, things look good on a paper, but not on implementation practically. And that's the problem that we are having here. We are having here right now with the direct provision. A, the group that was formed to look into these issues that were raised, because I think we've had in our previous three working groups. We're starting with a group of Judge Brian McCormann. And then we started with a second group that also did a case. And then now we have a third one that has come with the abolishment of direct provision, which to me, it is just a tokenism of the government trying to shut down all the voices that are marching to ask the institutionally built, built institutional that has built on racism over a type of certain marginalized group, right? Which is asylum seeker. For now, the government is under fire because everyone now knows what it is, what direct provision it is. And now the government knows that they set up this institution in a very wrong way, that it's been abused people from a day one. We actually can go back to the mothers and baby homes. This is the repeated history. We are going to go to Magdalena Laundry. This is the repeated history. So now what the government has come through is trying to overtake all of you and come with something that they know that it's going to be hard for groups or for people like organizations to argue with them. They'll say like, okay, on a paper, this is what we've actually done. We've actually allowed people in 2024, people are going to have independence. People are going to have their own rooms, their own keys. Ola, this is not about being in a house where you live by yourself when the whole system is wrong, right? I feel now we really need to to start having like tangible policies. And these policies has to be built not only on the government principle, but involve people like you, like I, like NGOs that have really worked so hard to actually build this, to actually fight for this system to be changing. I'm looking back in almost a decade where this system was, right? I can appreciate that they have done, it's not easy to make changes. They've done little changes, but it's not enough. It's really not enough. Like now what the government has only concentrated is only the living. What about the people's cases, right? What about identifying people that have disabilities that are going in this system? And how are you going to take care of those people? In every institution in Ireland, if you are talking in hospitals, if you are talking in schools, they have a basic simple thing, a standard menu that you cannot bring a patient in a hospital or you cannot give a child in school a standard menu just to say, you can't give a child this food. You can't give a child this fruit. You can't give a child this fruit. It's wrong. Why it is not even with direct provision? That they've not even looked into what people in direct provision are eating on their day-to-day basis. If we can actually just think of what forms a human substantial healthy living, it's what we put in our bodies. It's what we eat, right? And if the government does not even care for a basic meal of every day consumed for a person that's living in direct provision. And now we are talking about having homes, having keys on their doors, right? When we have not even taken care of mental health statuses of people that are living in this institution living. We have had problems in direct provision where people go and see a therapist or goes and see a psychiatrist and go and see a doctor. They've even some of them being told by a doctor, you know, I was even in one of those situations. You know what? When people find themselves in a situation where they want to go around it, they can come up with anything. That means people made up to have mental issues because they want to get papers. and to be able to live in Ireland. So there is a lot of things that needs to be dealt and honestly, truthfully, and not just being written on the paper, but practically implemented, and also being considered that these are no more living human beings that are going through this system. Speaking good English, understanding policies, does not identify or classify you not to be an asylum seeker, right? Because a president of a country can leave their country to come to any country in the world, which under Geneva Convention, every human being has the right to do that, to seek asylum, right? That doesn't diminish or belittle that person to be an asylum seeker, and for an immigration officer to call them that you are a liar. You are not an asylum seeker, but you are here for your own benefits. You just want to come here and squander things. This is the culture that it's in this system, institutional racism belt system. And that's what we have to first start killing. We have to start having an institution that has empathy, that has compassion, and that has an understanding based on the people's culture that are living in that sector, not only by academically or professionally, or being knowing that we are people that we can take care of that. This means that every individual from this marginalized group, they are entitled to sit on a body, to sit in a place, and even their views to be examined and added to the equal implementation that the government needs to do for a certain type of people. But this is just like imposing everything on us, imposing everything on the asylum and refugee and on refugee communities. So when I see a white paper, I'm sorry, Ola, I'll use this word, but forgive me on that. I see a white man in a black suit imposing what this system, it has to look like. And that's what I am looking at, right? And then trying to hide it a little bit by allowing a white woman heading this group so that it can look good. which is not a very good thing. So I think now the government needs to allow this process to be dealt with people, survivors of this system, and also people that culturally understand people that goes through this system, and not only how the living conditions are going to be, but also how from the start, which is when somebody enters into Ireland as a country, ask for asylum, and when they ask asylum, they have to start being processed. And from there, people that understand every step. I'm coming from Africa, Ola. And when I mean I'm coming from Africa, I've experienced both good and bad life of Africa. If you see people running away from Africa, coming over here, don't undermine them. There is worst things that happens over this side. And I'm not just making this up. And this is really true. And sometimes that's why people like I myself and many others, when I'm going in the street and taking risk and making noise, I know why I'm making this risk. Because I don't see anybody with a high leveled head, like from the background that I'm coming from, living where I came from, and say, I'm going to go to Ireland and put myself in this system for over a decade. Ola, it has taken so much pride from me. It has taken so much self-pity of me to allow to demean myself to sit there and went through this process. And I feel like the government can do better than what they've actually done today. I do appreciate very much. I do appreciate very much that they seem to be listening, but I think they are just going in lumber and shambles of trying to do this, but they can do the right way and the best way by adding people like you, I, and many others that can contribute to make this system perfect, better.
I think that piece that you're saying about making it about women-centered, but women who've been in the system. And I mean, it is good to hear, Ola, like in terms of the consultation with yourself, and I presume, you know, with others and with other you know, asylum-seeking organizations, migrant organizations. But you're so right, Ellie, like that's what has to be at the heart of this. And otherwise, it won't get implemented. It won't get implemented properly. It won't be rights-based implementation. And it's like so many, I think, other areas of women, unless it's women-centered and it's women leading that change, then it won't happen to meet their needs. And I also think, and I think it's really important to make the connection with the sort of institutional abuse that's happened in Ireland in our past. And people are so, you know, shocked, concerned about that and want to move away from it. But direct provision is that institutional abuse that's happening right now in Ireland. So if we're so shocked about what's happened in the past, we should be as shocked and angry about what's happening at the moment. I'm just going to finish with our theme in the National Women's Council for this International Women's Day is the future is feminist. So it's just maybe a final brief word from three of you, which I suppose it is a bit about your hopes in terms of that feminist future and how you want to see it. And I'll start with Ola.
It's Ola. All right. The future is feminist. Of course it is. And I would start off by saying I love being a woman, regardless of my circumstances now. I love being a woman. I love the fact that I am being me unapologetically. I love the fact that I'm multifaceted. I'm diverse in nature. You know, the me that you see in the classroom, I can turn it around and be a different me when I'm home. I'm a different me when I'm homeschooling my children. I'm a different me when it comes to different kind of things that I do with my life. And that is one of the qualities of being a woman. However, being locked in this system, how do we make the next Simone de Beauvoir of that woman who has been stripped of her rights, of her dignity, her self-esteem, and all that? How do you make the next Oprah Winfrey of that elderly woman who came here by virtue of what she was going through back home? How do you make the next Malala Yousafzai from the next young child whose life has been, you know, truncated by all the policies and all these, you can't do this, you can't do that, that goes on in the system? You know, these are the things that needs to be addressed for us to actually actualize our dreams. And I also say to women around me, I know they would say it's easier said than done, but regardless of that situation, regardless of I've been waiting for decades, you have two choices. You either let the system break you, or you break the system. Those are the choices. There's no in between. As you can't let the system, you know, make a mess of your life. I say to my children, I didn't cross seven rivers and seven seas just to come and sit down here and my life messed up. And my friend calls me a Madam United Nations. I see myself sitting on the board of directors of some, you know, multinational corporation someday. I don't see myself as that woman who was later given a leave to remain after 12 years or 13 years of going through this system. No, the future is me. The future is myself. The future is I. The future is women who went through this system and they rose above all these challenges. And they made a life of themselves and not the other way around. So the future is truly feminist. Yeah.
Thanks, Ola. Rosemary.
I wouldn't agree less with Ola. And I just want to say as much as personally now me, I've been bragging and complaining, but the future is feminist and there is a lot of support out there for women. There are different supports for women, which are empowering women, giving women a voice, and an empowered woman, a woman with a voice, there's nothing that can break that particular person. So once we empower women, once we give women a voice, even some of the issues that we are fighting about, domestic violence and all other, they're just going to go away because you cannot abuse an empowered woman.
Yeah, absolutely, Rosemary. Thank you. And final word to you, Ali.
The world now, then, and future is feminist. I am lucky to be right here in Ireland. And I'd love to see again another Mary Robinson from a more diverse culture to represent Ireland to the world. I am so proud that I can actually stand among millions of Irish people, mainly women, and be among all of them. And my voices being able to be encountered to be something that could bring change to Ireland as a country, and also to how women are going to be viewed for now, to the future, to the world. I'd love to be part of that. And every day of my journey, I've taken that journey very, very much seriously. And I would also hope to see our government to more recognize our female voices, support, empower us, and not be fearing of us, but understand that we want to be the leaders for now and the future.
Thanks, Ellie. And enormous thanks to the three of you. That was just, I think, so powerful and really important, I think, this discussion to be front and center on International Women's Week this year. And I know that from the three of you, yeah, if the three of you were right in the middle of implementing that white paper, I think the place would be in a much better state, even by the end of the year. So over to you, Rory.
Thank you so much, Orla. And thank you to Ola, to Ellie, and to Rosie. I think it was an incredible podcast. And just in terms of your listening to your experiences and views, and it's something, again, that, you know, I said at the start, and so many of us, you know, feel that this is a form of institutionalization. And it is, and your experience has shown it. And it is a human rights abuse as well, a human rights abuse. And, you know, what you've said there, you are leaders now and you are going to be future leaders. And I absolutely would like to see one of you as president of Ireland. I would like to see our next government appoint, as they have done this time, to the Shannon, a traveller, and Eileen Flynn. They should also appoint one of you, someone representing that, you know, experience and background and history and culture to our Shannon, and be in our Dáil and be in our national parliament. Ireland is changing and we stand in solidarity with you, and I thank you for everything you've done. And thank you, Orla, so much as well for these podcasts. They have been a real, I think, brilliant, and hopefully, you know, add to Women's Day. And
yeah, so they'll be going out over the week, and we're really delighted about that. These are just such an important part, because all of the podcasts have discussed the really critical issues for women. So enormous thanks to you, Rory, and to Reboot and to Tony for just facilitating this.
Yeah, no, it's great. And absolutely to Tony, who's producing them. And on that, I suppose, you know, we know, listeners, that, you know, you get a lot out of these. These are a really important platform, the Tortoise Shack platform, that's putting out so many podcasts, getting voices that need to be heard in the public. And this is what we're trying to do, to change Ireland, to get voices like you've heard today in the other podcasts. But we need your support. If you can become a patron, go over to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Support us whatever you can each month. We don't get advertising. We don't have sponsors. We rely completely on you to keep producing these. And we are a part of a process that will change Ireland. So we look forward to lots more. And thank you very much. And we'll talk to you soon.